Since August, all middle and high school students at Akron Public Schools have been banned from using their cell phones during the school day and have had to lock them in magnetic storage bags. Districts in 41 states are using these Yonder bags to keep students' phones inaccessible during the day. Just last week, Governor Mike DeWine said he supported legislation that would enforce phone bans at all Ohio schools. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Today, we'll talk to staff at Akron Public Schools to find out what changes they've seen in the classroom and in the hallway since implementing the phone ban. We'll talk to a national reporter about other similar bans, and we'll ask local psychologists about the impact smartphones and social media have on kids. Later, we'll talk to an honoree on the Cranes Cleveland Business 8 over 80 list, philanthropist Ron Harrington. Those conversations coming up. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks for joining us. It's been over a year since Akron Public Schools implemented its pilot program at three middle and high schools banning the use of students' smartphones. And last fall, this was expanded to all middle and high schools in the district. It's implementing the ban using magnetically sealed cell phone pouches by a startup company called Yonder. Just last week, Governor Mike DeWine announced his support for a new bill proposal that would require all K-12 schools statewide to limit or ban in-school cell phone use by students. We're going to start today's show with a look at how Akron's policy has fared and how it's impacted students' learning progress and behavioral development, as well as how parents, teachers, and other school staff feel about it. And we'll talk to local and national experts about how smartphones are impacting young people. Later this hour, we'll meet an inspiring 81-year-old philanthropist who was honored this year as part of the Cranes Cleveland Business 8 over 80 list. First, let's discuss the smartphone ban. Joining me now by phone is Don Zessiger, Director of Safety and Security at Akron Public Schools. Thanks so much for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We have Dr. Eric Merkel, licensed school psychologist and central office school psychologist at Akron Public Schools. Dr. Merkel, thanks for calling in as well.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us.
We also have Anna North, senior correspondent for Vox Media. Good morning, Anna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we have Dr. Vince Carringi, Chief Medical Officer at the Centers for Families and Children in Cleveland. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jenny. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning to all of you. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soy@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Dr. Carringi, you are a psychiatrist, and with all the patients that you are seeing, what do you think the common effects of smartphone and social media, other electronic devices, are on children, and are there telltale signs that a child might be in trouble when it comes to those devices, social media, et cetera?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that answer is twofold for me in the sense that we can expand a little bit on talking about what are some of the things that research is showing about how smartphones specifically and social media use are affecting young people. But I think about it in terms of my job and what I'm asked to do when they show up to the office with perhaps a concern from their parent or the teacher about anxiety or depression or school avoidance or ADHD. I've had to sort of factor into my assessment, how do you use a phone? How do you have access to that phone in school or at home during homework, just to determine if that's an impact itself in terms of some of the presenting symptoms that they're having. So it's both in terms of assessing, but also then understanding how is it contributing. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that we have the time to wait for the research to really bear out and prove and show this is what's happening. The trend that we're seeing is concerning enough. I think we have to take some action.
And why is it concerning?
Well, I mean, I think the if you actually go back and look at some of the concerning trends for mental health concerns in young people, they actually predate the most recent concern that people want to say might have propagated some of these things like the COVID pandemic. It actually dates back to essentially when smartphones and cell phones came to be the norm. If you go back to 2010, there's been a 145% increase in the diagnosis of depression in teenage girls, 161% increase in teenage boys. And if you look at anxiety, it's about 140% increase in that age group over that time. And that dates back to about when Pew Research showed that around that time, only about 23% of kids had smartphones back in 2011. 5 years later, 80% of kids. By 2016, 80% of kids owned a smartphone, and 28% of those kids were between 8 and 12 years old. So it really showed that the trend that we're seeing actually dates back to some of this technology being on the increase of use.
And Anna, I'd like to ask you through your reporting, I mean, have you seen any data when it comes to amount of usage a teen or a child might have if they do have a smartphone? How much time spent looking at YouTube videos or, you know, scrolling on Snapchat or Instagram?
Yeah, thanks so much. I mean, it's really wonderful to hear from experts on this. And I think this is such a complicated area. We do see, you know, teens and younger children spending a large amount of time on these devices. I believe, if I'm correct, that one survey talked to kids and said that one third were spending, they put it as like almost all the time on social media or on a smartphone. But it varies a lot from survey to survey. And of course, this is also a family issue. So different families, you know, can put different limits on the amount of time they spend on their device. And of course, as we're seeing in Akron and elsewhere, schools and school districts have a role to play here too.
Dawn, Akron, speaking of, implemented this pilot program for several months at some of the schools, I believe three in the district, and then eventually expanded it. So can you elaborate for us more on what you found during the pilot period and the efficacy of having a phone ban, and what was so convincing that the district decided, let's apply this to all of Akron's middle and high schools?
So some of the things we've already talked about were concerning to us, but I guess our primary focus was safety. And we were seeing a disturbing trend of physical conflicts, fights with staged fights, filming fights, and then posting fights on social media. And it was very disturbing. It was we had a cell phone policy in place, but there was no uniform enforcement. And it makes it really tough for teachers to have to, who are focused on the academic portion, to also have to be the phone police. So we were looking for something that could help us navigate that. So we saw the Yonder Bags. It caught our interest. We actually went to Dayton Public Schools because they had implemented it, and we wanted to see how it worked. We liked what we saw. So, as
you mentioned,
we tried this. What did
you see at Dayton?
Well, we saw how the process worked. The Yonder Bags are actually issued to the students, so they keep them for the school year, so they take them home with them. They come to school in the morning, they have their Yonder pouch, they put their cell phone in the Yonder pouch, shut it off. There's a locking mechanism on it, and then they keep it with them for the school day. At the end of the day, there's a magnet that unlocks the bag, and their phone, they can take their phone out of their bag, and they leave the school with their phone and their bag, you know, to go about their day. And it was a smooth, efficient process as far as the entry process into the school, and we liked what we saw. So we decided to implement that last year as a pilot in three of our schools. And initially there was some pushback. I think the students felt like this is something they're used to having all day, so they felt like it was a punishment. There were parents that were concerned with safety because they thought they had to have an instant connection to their child. So we had a lot of conversations around that. We did a survey at the end of it and found that the results were favorable. Some of the students even admitted that their stress levels and anxiety went down because they kind of unplugged from this technology while they were at school. And before, like if you walked into the lunchroom, you'd see kids sitting around a table right next to each other and all of them are on their phones, whereas now they don't have that option. So they have to use their interpersonal skills, have conversations, and we feel like the climate is better. It's calmer. It's more peaceful. We don't have as much of this problems with the phones in physical conflicts that we did. I don't have any hard data around that, but as an example, we have cameras in our schools so we can see what happens when there's a fight, for example.
So at Akron Public Schools, I'm sorry to interrupt, but at Akron Public Schools, you have cameras, what, throughout the hallways and in areas that you aren't always just kind of physically monitoring?
Correct. In gymnasiums, hallways, entry points. We would see if there was a fight, for example. I could, you know, pull up the camera, watch what's happening, and there would be, you know, 50, 60 kids standing there with cell phones filming the event.
Wow.
It was really disturbing. So we knew we had to do something about that. And the Yonder bags have helped us with that in particular.
You know, it's so interesting, just as kind of an adult thinking about the situation, you know, when I think about schools and banning phone use, my first thought is about academics and going, oh, this will help in the classroom, because if you're not scrolling and being distracted by social media, then the teacher can actually teach you something or try to create some sort of dialogue, especially when we're coming out of a time of the pandemic. And, you know, as a former education reporter, learning loss was something that I was reporting on all the time. But to think about these fights and these kids wanting to kind of get their 15 minutes of fame through likes of a video that promotes violence is just horrifying to me. That's my two cents. But I wonder, Eric, I mean, what in your perspective were some of the positive results you have seen since August implementing this phone ban through all the middle and high schools?
Yeah, so for a lot of families and students alike, the idea that we were going to not allow access to cell phones was a pretty catastrophic moment, if we can imagine just how ubiquitous they are in society.
Sure.
And the fact that cell phones just really are a part of everything we do. But once we got past that initial moment where the idea that we'd be untethered from these cell phones, we quickly saw, to Don's point, that our teachers did not have to overly police all of the activities happening on the phone. And we could see then that the focus became about learning. And remember, in the school environment, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is provide curriculum and a prescribed set of experience so that students can have academic success. And at the same time, we also have to appreciate that phones, although they have so many benefits, and we certainly can unpack those as well, they are distraction devices. And by not having the endless pinging of notifications and other activities coming through, our students were able then to put their energies into the learning process, not worrying about what's happening on social media, not engaging back and forth with various communications with peers. And their focus could be on the academic experience in the instructional environment versus trying to simultaneous multitask all of these competing demands ineffectively.
No, absolutely, because that is right, because suddenly a child is looking at their phone and saying, oh, hey, I want to fit in. I want to respond to a group thread or respond to something on social media while they're also trying to learn in school. I got an email from Jeff in Moreland Hills who asks about the Akron School phone policy. How strong has the pushback been, and has APS been forced to make any individual exceptions to this policy? I will direct that question to Don or Eric.
So that's a great question.
Yeah, let you respond.
Yeah. So initially, that's a great question. Initially, there was some pushback. Like I said, a lot of the kids felt like it was a punishment because it's something they're used to having. Some of the parents felt like they needed an instant connection around safety. And I said, the last thing I want is a student on their cell phone if there's an emergency in the school. I want them taking direction from the school administrators so we can get them to a place of safety. A lot of students on their cell phones at one time could compromise a cell tower. Also, if we have parents rushing to the schools, it disrupts the ability of the safety forces to respond in a timely manner. So All those things were happening on the initial implementation. Now I don't get calls from parents. It's become the new normal.
And Anna, do you think nationwide pushback has been similar in nature about the use of a school ban, or specifically about these yonder bags, which is a specific type of implementation as opposed to just kind of saying you can't use your phone in the classroom or in the hallways?
Right. So we've seen the yonder bags specifically becoming more popular quite recently. School districts in at least 41 states have started using them in the last couple of years. And, you know, school districts, including Akron, have said, like, there's a reason to use these bags, that it actually eliminates the kind of back and forth between student and teacher that used to happen. If you just sort of say you're not allowed to have your phone out in class, then the teacher has to enforce that. But if the phone is locked up in this magnetic pouch that can actually only be unlocked by a special device that might be, say, at the front desk or as the child leaves school, then it's, you know, much harder to have that kind of pushback and argument. It really helps focus on learning. So there is a lot of popularity of these bags in the districts that have used them. And in general, administrators and teachers have been really positive about the results. There's been some pushback among students and student groups. And some of the reasons I've seen include students might have responsibility for picking up a younger sibling, and they might need to coordinate that with a parent. There might be a parent with a chronic illness who might need to notify a student. They might not be able to do pickup that day. And some students with chronic illnesses need their phones during the day. For example, there are apps that help people manage diabetes. But my understanding is that for at least some of these situations, schools and districts have and can create workarounds or can create exceptions so someone can have a phone if they really need it.
If you'd like to participate in the conversation, have a thought about phones and phone bans at schools, we'd love to hear from you. The number is toll-free. It's 866-578-0903, or you can shoot us an email at soi@ideastream.org. Dr. Karenji, I wonder, when you hear about parents, you know, initially pushing back on a school phone ban on a campus, and there is something about everyone's sense of immediacy that you can now have with these phones, do you wonder if parents are somewhat projecting their own relationship with the phone on the child? I mean, are these smartphones, I've read a lot of data that it seems to be changing the chemistry of society in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I will tell you that I've had my most success working with parents when I have a conversation with them, honestly, and try to offer them some level of education, right? If that's a physiological brain and behavior type of education. Going back to one of your points, which I think gets at the core of what you might call like attention fragmentation from a student in school, what they're, you know, hoping to pay attention to. The most recent research shows that kids get 240 app notifications a day. So that's great. That's a great number to focus on. I think about the kids when I have a talk with them about how they're using their phone and apps they're on and what they're using. It's not the 240 they get. It's the 5 or 6 they're waiting on. Did so-and-so reply to me yet? Did so-and-so like my... And that's not even a notification yet. They're spending so much of their time and energy thinking about the things that haven't yet happened. So I worry about that, because what we know about attention is that physiologically, the part of our brain that is dedicated to attention span is physiologically limited. And so when we put our kids or adults in this sort of state of constant alertness, in this always having to be aware and alert, what happens physiologically is your stress hormones need to support that. The stress hormones of adrenaline and cortisol need to create a space where you're always on and always looking. The problem with that is that those hormones actually overtake the ones that our body naturally produces, like cortisol and serotonin and dopamine, that are naturally produced, which would help us have a calm and happy state. So you're putting yourself into this almost fight or flight, this constant state of alertness, and those chemicals are really strongly supporting your ability to be attentive to all kinds of threats, but it doesn't allow you to be in a place of learning.
So my understanding of what you're telling me is it's hitting these young, susceptible, still developing kids and teens with their attention spans and with there's a limitation to how much you can pay attention to, and then also with what is creating their happiness levels. If you're getting dopamine hits from these smartphones and that's what you're focusing on, I don't know. It really seems like it's getting kids from all directions.
Yeah. I mean, I want to be very sensitive to the addiction experts and be thoughtful about using that word.
Sure.
Addiction, the research really depends a lot on the not just the behavioral elements, but the physiological elements. So I try to use problematic use.
Sure.
Right? And so the research shows 5 to 15% of kids that have smartphones will develop problematic use. So first of all, we have to agree that we're willing to give kids a device that at least 1 out of 10 is going to develop problematic use with. And I'm not sure any parent or caregiver would thinking of it that way would say, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea. Let's take our chances on 10% of kids having problematic use with this element." But what you're getting at is, and you could probably have an entire session on this alone, is some of these technology and app creators have researched how essentially to hijack the brain's dopamine reward system to increase the kids' cravings for screen time.
Well, I mean, if anyone who's seen The Social Dilemma on Netflix and has seen those interviews with former engineers for some of the big app makers said that's exactly what they were doing, was creating dopamine hits that replicate cocaine use.
Yep.
Or drug use. And now, you know, whether you accept, you know, these kind of whistleblower type testimonies or not, that's how they say, you know, you keep coming back for that ding of your phone or an alert to a new hit. Let's take a phone call. Laxmi is calling from Twinsburg. Good morning, and thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I want to say kudos to Akron and Dayton schools for doing what they're doing, because I think it's extremely commendable what they're doing. But however, as a parent of a teenager, I've seen up close the dopamine hits, as you say, when the kid is given excessive screen time or phone time. And as a parent, I always struggle as to what is the optimal amount of time these kids should be spending on their phones. And it has always been distressing for me that, you know, they go to school to learn and not to be on their phones. And all these schools, and my kid goes to a private school, they have this open policy that you have to be responsible for your time, and these kids are roaming around with their phones. So if I text my daughter and I get a response back, my first question is, why do you have your phone on? And then she texts back saying, why do you text me? I'm in school. But it's a two-way street. It's a two-way street. I understand that. But I honestly think school is for learning. Keep the phones away. And I think one of your panelists said, if someone has a medical condition like diabetes or other things, oh, sure, all of us have gone through that in our childhood. People have gone through that. And I know technology has gone multiple times. But the thing is, we have a nurse's station. Children should not be given an exception to hold on to their phones, because that's when everybody will make an excuse to get their phone. So nurse station is where it has to be. So if it pings saying their diabetes is out of control or whatever, then the nurse should move into action. So that's my two bits. But I think parents have a lot to do. And I commend Akron and Dayton for doing what they're doing, because they are doing the parent's job, essentially. So thank you.
No, absolutely. And Laxmi, you're certainly not alone. I think a lot of, if not all, parents share in this, and even assessing your own use and the example that we set for kids, and then how much kids are on the phones and how much you know, they're learning when they're at school. Dawn, I want to ask you, has there been variance, or has there been any learning lessons in your implementation of the school phone ban that you have needed to make changes about how it's applied in the middle and high schools? Has there been conversations about making sure that the younger kids aren't using school smartphones at schools?
So some of the things that we've talked about, like the medical situations, we do have exceptions for those. We have yonder bags that have a Velcro closure. So if a physician would prescribe a documented need to have a cell phone, like what we're talking about, a diabetes situation, for example, where glucose needs to be monitored, that is allowable. But as far as adjustments, no. It's worked well for us. We have, if we have was I going to say here? I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Well, we can easily come back to you when you pick up that thought again. Let me go to Eric then and ask. You know, I'm curious. We talk so much about teenage girls and the use of smartphones and social media. What have you seen as essentially the district psychologist about girls coming to you or reaching out in any capacity about the stresses that they experience when it comes to pressure and maybe the exaggeration of that pressure through smartphones?
That's right. So as we've already talked about the inherently almost addictive or at least certainly reinforcing nature of the cell phones, we are finding that folks are going on to their social media to, and certainly it's not just children, we should also point out that it's equally adults, and they're using that to have these artificial comparisons or expectations to others in their lives to actually, you know, in some ways, look at these aspirational ideas of what maybe someone is doing, what they're wearing. Are they on vacation somewhere? Did they purchase something? And then as a consequence of that, they're starting to make some judgments about the overall quality of their life, which is then impacting their self-esteem because they feel as though they're not living up. And again, all of us have done that when we've watched maybe some of our friends or others in our social circles get something, go somewhere, do something. So our concern here is that as a mental health element, in addition to all the things we've talked about with attention, is that the cell phone itself is potentially serving almost a way to help us make these artificial comparisons to other people in a way that is causing us to feel bad about ourselves or at least judge ourselves in an unfavorable way.
You know, I do have to ask, Anna, I know that in your reporting, you I think used an example of teen magazines like 17 and other ways in which the history of teen girls comparing themselves with ideals or other stars out there has always existed. Do you find that smartphones are being vilified in any way? I know there's those that say maybe the efficacy of these bans are in question. What's your reporting led you to?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of reporting on young people and body image and social comparison, and the picture is really mixed. So, you know, one thing we know is that, as you're saying, there have always been ways for young people to kind of compare themselves to others. And we think about, you know, my generation, right? I'm a millennial. We talk about this famous 17 magazine cover, you know, that talked about, oh, this is a real body, you know, this is so normal. And of course, the young woman is so thin and everybody's looking at this thinking this is what I'm supposed to look like, right? So there have always been sort of these ways of, you know, media really telling young girls how they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to look like and act like. And I think social media is just another iteration of that and has pros and cons. When you talk to young people and folks who work with them, you'll hear about these pros and cons. The obvious con is that you're seeing many, many more images, right, than you used to be. If you got a 17 magazine, you know, anybody who's listening and remembers flipping through a magazine, you can flip through it with your friend in an afternoon. There's a limited number of pages there. But of course, on your phone, there are an unlimited number of images. And many of them are, you know, retouched. There's filters. This is not going to be realistic. And you might not be able to tell the ways in which it's retouched or filtered. So these are all concerns. The pros are that social media has also been a place where a lot of body positivity movements have begun, and teenagers are able to share body positive comments with one another and get support, especially for teens from marginalized groups, especially LGBTQ teens. You know, there's research showing that social media can be a real lifeline and can be a place where people find positivity and find community that they might not be finding necessarily in their school or in their neighborhood. So I think it's just incredibly complex when it comes to comparison, when it comes to mental health. It's not an area where we find incredibly easy answers.
So when you hear that, Dr. Karinji, I mean, do you agree with that? Or is there a time and a place for saying, Well, you can put your phone down for now.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. First of all, the most important word that I think I heard and said there was complex. It's an increasingly Absolutely. Complex issue that we're still not fully aware of all the research. You know, I want to get back to something that was just hit on in terms of maybe even the differences, not just with girls, but also with boys, is that one of the dangers and concerns that I've noticed and I've seen and the research bears out is historically, culturally here, boys tend to manage their conflicts physically, you know, get in a fight and you sort of deal with it that way. The research sort of shows that girls tend to manage that kind of conflict relationally. And so, unfortunately, social media and these apps and just virtual technology in general has afforded these opportunities where friend groups can kind of freeze out certain people. You can't escape it. It's all day. It's every day. It's weekends. It's school days. And the relational component of how it affects young girls is bearing out. Some of the research in terms of the girls that show up for the most extreme mental health concerns are higher than the boys. 91% increase in suicide rates in boys, but a 161% increase in suicide rates in girls from 10 to 14 over the last 10 or 15 years. To the point where now more than 1 in 5 high school students seriously considered suicide in the last CDC studies in 2021. So these are the extremes of mental conflict and some of the challenges that they're having. And the correlation to technology, to smartphones, to these apps is just too close to ignore.
I want to share an email from Emily in Cleveland who says, I work in youth programming and both the research and my professional experience tells me the kids need a break from phones. My kids are just 5 and 7, but thinking ahead to high school, I'm already worried about finding a school that doesn't allow phones. This is a must for us. So, you know, in that respect, Emily putting the onus on herself as the parent, ultimately, which everyone must do, in trying to figure out what the appropriate dynamic is for the child and the phone. Let's take a call from Carol in West Salem, who's calling in. Carol, good morning. Well, Carol, I know had talked to our screener and said that she was a mother of young kids with ADHD who have struggles in school, and I use phones to text them to remind them to do certain things, so it can be helpful for them to have phones. So I guess that would fall in the category of exceptions. I don't know, though, would a district want to say, well, if your kid has ADHD, then you're allowed to have access to them when other kids don't. But it does speak to the fact that for some parents, there is an important use of these phones. Don, I'm wondering, have other districts come to you and asked about your policies with school phone bans and to see if they want to implement something like that at their district?
Yes, I have that all the time, and I'm happy to share that. We had to have a policy around how does it work if there's a violation, you know, so we have a progressive discipline policy. You do have, at times, students will damage their pouch, so we have a replacement fee for that. If they come to school and they don't have their pouch, then they give their phone to an administrator, it's put in an envelope, and they get it back at the end of the day. One interesting thing is we have some kids that would rather just give their phone to the administrator and not have it throughout the day. So, like I say, there's been a lot of positives around how this has gone for us.
Anna, I know that Indiana, as essentially a state, has passed legislation saying that phones are to be banned at schools. What are you seeing nationwide as far as the landscape when it comes to that kind of holistic action against phone use at schools?
Yeah, I think this is a growing debate, not just at the district level, but at the state level. You know, you mentioned there's state level action under consideration in Ohio as well. Here in New York City, where I'm based, I know that there are schools individually who have been talking about this ban, and I know it's something that New York City actually had a phone ban in the past that was reversed. I think there's debate now about whether to reinstate that. And it's not just in the U.S. Actually, schools in a couple of European countries have banned phones as well. So it's sort of I think this is a growing area of debate and conversation, really not just around the country but around the world.
And Eric, I'm curious. Do you have parents that come to you with concerns about their kids' cell phone use or their own use? Or I guess this would be an opportunity for you to kind of give any sort of advice for parents who wonder about how much should I let my kids be on their phones? Can I possibly limit it? You know, these teens kind of want to set their own rules. So I'm sure that's a very difficult conversation to have.
It is. And I think one of the real themes here is that we need our caregivers to also not just brush up on their own technology literacy, because so many families at this point feel so ill at ease to understand smartphones and new media technology and the personal communication devices and all the apps. So there is a learning curve for our families and caregivers to actually understand this technology themselves. And then the next part is really putting those types of limits on the phone. So an hour before bedtime, for example, turn off all of these personal communication devices so that we're not getting the infiltrate of the blue light and all the disruptions it can have into our sleep. Making sure that we have areas like distraction-free homework where cell phones and other devices are put away, allowing for things like phone-free meals or family times so that, and that's also true for the family and the caregivers, so that you can really focus on the communication, the relationship building. But parents at the same time also have to be in some ways responsible stewards themselves, checking phone, looking at apps, checking the content of text message, using the monitoring software, keeping tabs on what their kids are doing. And again, making sure that they're building that capacity. And then also having frank and honest and authentic conversations about what are some of the dangers of the internet. You know, I do a lot of training on internet literacy for families, and I always use the expression, don't let the internet be your child's babysitter. And the point there is that there are so many benefits to these technologies and AI and all the learning that we can do and get questions answered, but we also have to be strong consumers of what we find online and understanding misinformation, disinformation, biased information, understanding that there are predators and unsafe places also online, and having those very authentic conversations, which then can open the door into a lot of other directions. And too, Jenny, I did want to circle back to that idea about carve-outs, especially for access for students with disabilities. If a provider were to indicate that a device is needed as a part of a medical treatment plan, that's certainly something that school districts are going to afford through ADA and Section 504, possibly special education. So there are ways in which students who absolutely need to have a phone as a legitimate device right. to support their conditions, absolutely will have that access.
Dr. Eric Merkel with Akron Public Schools, Don Zesiger with Akron Public Schools, Anna Norris, senior correspondent for Vox Media, and Dr. Vince Karinji with the Centers for Families and Children in Cleveland. I appreciate your time and thank you so much for participating in this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My thanks to
Thank
all
you.
Of you.
Thanks, Jenny.
We'll take a short break now, and on the other side, we're going to meet an inspiring octogenarian honored by Crain's Cleveland Business in their 8 over 80 award this year. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for staying with us. Crain's Cleveland Businesses Month named outstanding octogenarians in its annual 8 over 80 awards. These people have lived incredible lives and careers over continuing to make an impact in their community. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll meet some of the year's inspiring class, starting today with 81-year-old philanthropist Ron Harrington, who helped establish the Harrington Heart and Vascular Institute at University Hospitals and co-founded the Harrington Project for Discovery and Development, which funds efforts to bring new cures and treatments to patients around the world. Ron, thanks so much for joining us by phone, and congratulations on receiving this honor.
Well, thanks, Jenny. It's humbling and most appreciated.
Well, I'm glad. And if you, any of our listeners, want to ask Ron a question or have a comment, you can call us 866-578-0903. Once again, 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Ron, from my reading, I know that you grew up in Rocky River and after college went to Ohio State. And you ended up working for a few companies like General Foods and the cosmetics company Bonbell before starting an entrepreneurial streak that became incredibly successful. Can you tell us what drove you to ultimately running your own business?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Actually, I have always had a desire to have my own business, and then as that thought evolved more, I thought, wouldn't it be kind of cool to have a business where your family was also involved? So with that in mind, our business was kind of created with my wife and myself, and Nance and I, were on board at the very beginning when we started this whole thing, and then as it grew, a year or two later, we brought in our daughter, and then we brought in our son, and then we thought, well, let's carry it a little further. We brought the dogs in, and then in addition to that, we had the grandchildren on catalogs and involved in some of the promotions. So that made it a lot more fun.
So I'm assuming you're talking about Edge Park Medical Supplies. That is what you and Nancy bought in 1990. And so you said you brought your son and daughter in, and this small company, I read, evolved to 8 warehouses across the country. Some people say family and business don't mix. What was the secret to your success, and how did that work so well for you?
You know, that's a great question, because that was something that was constantly on my mind. And I guess what I've always tried to do, and I learned at a very young age, is keep the word I out of my vocabulary. And so what I tried to do is use the 4 most important words in leadership. What do you think? And as a result, I think that it made it more palatable for our family to work together. And for all the years we worked together, I don't ever recall a disagreement in business that we ever had, which, is, to me, was awesome. And to Nance, that was awesome also.
And I do want to add, you were so successful in leaving the I out and essentially approaching this as a team that about a decade ago, I believe, your company was sold to Cardinal Health for a mere sum of $2 billion. So congratulations on that business success. Now, let's talk about your philanthropy, because as I understand it, it was in your late 50s when you underwent a quadruple bypass surgery, that those two worlds kind of meshed for you. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's another interesting aspect. And, I've always wondered, and I'm sure as everyone else does, how things happen like this. But I was a marathon runner and worked out every day. And in that result of that is that one day, I was on an EKG stress test in a physical, and they discovered, I always had this philosophy where I'd go in to get that test. I got it every year, and I'd say, would you mind if I tried to break the record? Who's got the longest time on this treadmill? And they said, sure, not a problem. They give me the number and I'd try to do it. So that made it at least a little more interesting, because I did it every year, because my dad had died of a heart attack at 47 when I was 7 years old.
Sorry to hear that.
So it all kind of came together that I tried to focus on exercise and staying healthy. And as a result, when I went in for that quadruple bypass, I was out in 3.5 days. And 6 weeks later, I was running 6 miles a day and lifting weights. And that was when I was 58, and I'm 81 now. So
wow.
I've been blessed and lucky, and I don't know. Things happen that way. And so as a result, to your question, I think, you know, when much is given, much is expected. And that's kind of a philosophy that our family's always followed. And as a result, the grateful patient coming out of an operation like that, and I'm thankful to Joe Sabic, who did this for me, gosh, 23, 24 years ago. And he, you know, as a result, I take 2 pills a day, and that's the extent of, and I work out still every day of my life. So, yeah, and that grateful patient led into the gift.
Gave back big. Gave,
yeah, university hospitals.
So let's talk about that. Dr. Joe Sabic, now the head of surgery at University Hospitals, and your family donation helped establish the Harrington Heart and Vascular Institute in 2008. You then went on to launch the Harrington Project for Discovery and Development. So tell me why you wanted to invest in these areas of medicine. Was it the role of the grateful patient?
Yeah, you know, Jenny, it was the role of the grateful patient for sure when we created the Harrington Heart and Vascular Institute at University Hospitals. So I'd say, yeah, on that one. And then in the Discovery Institute, the Harrington Discovery Institute that we later invested in, that was a little different. It was something that intrigued us because of the nonprofit tied to an entrepreneurial effort.
Nice.
So in other words, we had a nonprofit tied to a for-profit, and I like that as opposed to just a government tie-in. So that's kind of one of the things that really was a sizzle on this thing.
So the Discovery and Development Initiative has expanded well beyond university hospitals. There are partnerships with Morgan Stanley, the University of Oxford. There were other companies and clinical trial efforts involved. Do you ever think about how many lives will be impacted by this initiative?
You know, at first blush, we never did. But we, you know, we always thought as a family, wouldn't it make sense to try this? And because no one's doing it, and you know, the opportunity came about because of our exposure to Dr. Jonathan Stamler at University Hospitals, who was previously at Harvard and Duke, and we met him, and. Dan Simon was also very much involved in the introduction to Jonathan because they were both at Harvard together. And we just kind of liked the chemistry and we liked the feel for Jonathan's entrepreneurial spirit. And so he truthfully, Jenny, has led the whole thing. He's the man. And I go to a lot of different things and organizations and all these 12 years that we've been working together very closely. And he's a rock star and he's very humble about it. And I don't know, we get along great.
Ron, I know that you spoke to our producer prior to our interview to catch up, and you told her that you were not the best student growing up, but your efforts now are making huge waves in medical research. I would love to hear what your thoughts might be and what advice you might give a younger person who wants to make a difference within their career and then beyond.
Yeah. Well, obviously, education is a prerequisite for becoming something that you might not expect to become. So my exposure was I never really had a mentor. My dad died when I was seven, and, you know, my mom went to work. My aunt kind of raised me for 7 years, and those years were kind of informative years, and one thing led to another, so I probably wasn't the best student, the best athlete, the best of anything. But, you know, it's kind of like you keep your head down and plow through it, and by the way, hang around with some people that are a lot smarter.
Right.
And that's what I've always tried to do, and better. And so, you know, I kind of got lucky, and I always credit it with being blessed and being lucky.
Ron Harrington, philanthropist and co-founder of the Harrington Project for Discovery and Development, thanks so much for joining us today. That was one of this year's Crain's Cleveland Business 8 over 80 honorees. Thank you so much, Ron. I appreciate talking to you. We'll meet.
Nice talking to you.
Take care. We'll meet more from this year's class over the next 2 weeks. You can check out all the profiles of this year's recipients by going to cranescleveland.com. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_ or on Instagram at @JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll discuss the latest regarding electric vehicles, what falling prices, production facilities here in Ohio, and more charging stations mean for the consumer, plus how some cities want to limit the number of dollar stores. If you missed any portion of the program, you can find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rude, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast. And our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.